Welcome to the Reformed Academy podcast, a production of Reformed Forum. My name is Camden Busey. Reformed Academy seeks to provide educational guidance through a structured learning environment. Join more than 3,800 students in 75 countries who are growing in their knowledge and love for Jesus Christ, revealed in all of Scripture. Take responsibility for your theological education. Redeem your time. Theological study is not just for pastors and scholars. Our mission is to present every person mature in Christ. And so, in this episode, we continue with Lane Tipton's course, Introduction to the Theology and Apologetics of Cornelius Van Til. This is part of an 8-course series we have developed on Van Til for our fellowship in Reformed Apologetics. Today, we will consider idealism.
It's time now for us to address Van Til's relationship to idealism or idealisms, because idealism is not a monolithic philosophical movement. And this is an odd phenomenon, but Van Til has been accused by a number of theologians, the De Boers in the Calvin Forum, John Vanderstelt in Philosophy and Scripture, more recently by R.C. Sproul, John Gershner, John Fesco, Keith Matheson, of being an idealist of some sort. And before we address whether or not Van Til is an idealist, I think the previous lectures have made quite clear that he can't be. But before we address that more specifically, it's important to understand basically what idealism is and get a couple of working examples in place so that we can assess the claim whether or not Van Til is an idealist. Now, idealism is typically set over against realism. Idealism is typically an antagonism to realism. And I'll tell you the quickest and easiest way to distinguish idealism from realism. According to idealism, objects conform to the knowing subject. The knowing mind makes the objects it perceives conform to it and either constitute the intelligibility of their appearance, a softer form of idealism, or constitute the objects themselves, a stronger form of idealism. But the point is that objects conform to the mind. Mind has structures that conform objects to it. For realism, minds conform to their objects. And so it's the very reverse. Minds conform to objects. And it's if you've studied the history of philosophy, this is typically a great chasm or gulf that separates philosophers. Now, I don't want to give you a thorough and full lecture just on this point, but I want you to be aware of one of the most important works that Van Til ever wrote, The Survey of Christian Epistemology. I'll just put SCE up here. And in that work, Van Til says something that is absolutely indispensable if you're going to understand what he's talking about and you wish to understand his perspective on idealism in relation to realism. Here's what he says. He says that the debate between the idealist and realist typically is how the finite mind relates to finite objects. And the idealists will claim that the mind of man makes objects conform to it. A supreme example of that is Kant. And the realist would say that the finite mind conforms to the objects of experience. And so it's a purely vertical relationship between the subject that's conforming objects to it or objects that are conforming the subject to it. But what I want you to notice is that these lines are purely horizontal lines that are talking about the relationship of creatures and the objects known by creatures. Van Til says that is not the most basic question to ask in epistemology. He would say in response to both of these is the more basic question is how do created subjects and objects relate to the self-contained triune God, to his being, to his decree, and to his revelation. And so from one standpoint, Van Til looks at the debate between idealism and realism and says that the more basic question that must be asked before we talk about how finite subjects relate to finite objects and finite objects relate to finite subjects is how each relates to the self-contained triune God. And so that is Van Til's general approach to this issue. Now, what I want us to do is I want to try to give you a couple of examples of idealism in order to help you better understand the nature of the claim that Van Til either is or is not an idealist. And the two species of idealism I want us to consider, just for the purposes of introduction to this course, and this is not an exhaustive treatment of either figure, as I want to talk to you about Kantian idealism, or what can also be known as transcendental idealism, and then secondly, Hegelian, or what can be known as absolute idealism. Kantian or transcendental idealism. Immanuel Kant, whose dates are 1724 to 1804, was a true crossroads in the history of Western philosophy. Hume died in 1776, and Kant published his magnum opus, The Critique of Pure Reason, at that time. And David Hume was the one who famously awakened Kant from his dogmatic slumbers. Now, Hume had destroyed science and had led to a dead end in skepticism. And Immanuel Kant was trying to address the skepticism that had been introduced by David Hume. And Kant was brought to a point where he had to rethink the nature of philosophy at a programmatic level. And Kant likened his insight in philosophy to a Copernican revolution in philosophy. And I want to explain it to you as basically and non-technically as I know how by way of introduction. Copernicus, remember, most had assumed that the Earth was a fixed, still point in the middle of the universe, geocentrism. And he suggested that the Earth is moving and not the center of the universe. The sun is the center, heliocentrism. Now, for our purposes, here's the image that you need to have in mind. Copernicus took, instead of thinking of the Earth as fixed and static, he thought of the Earth as dynamic and moving. And Kant said that there was a fundamental problem that the philosophers of his day shared, whether they were continental philosophers or whether they were British empiricist philosophers, whether they were rationalists on the one side or whether they were empiricists on the other side, they all had a common assumption. And it's that the mind passively receives its objects and conforms to them. In Hume's philosophy, the mind received sensations from an external world. In Descartes, Leibniz, or Spinoza's philosophy, the mind received data. In fact, John Locke famously described the situation by saying the mind is a tabula rasa, that is, a blank slate on which experience writes. Every idea that's in the mind is written on the mind from outside, and the mind is a passive receiver of information, of experience. Experience writes on a clean slate of the passive mind, and that mind merely receives and organizes the data of experience. But Kant offered the idea that the mind is actively constructive of experience. That spells constructive in some world. Kant offers a Copernican revolution and says that the mind is constructive in the way that it deals with sense data. And I studied philosophy years and years ago under Greg Bahnsen. And Bahnsen used an illustration that has stuck with me all through the years, that the difference between Locke and the philosophers prior to Kant and Kant is the difference between typewriter paper and a word processing program. Typewriter paper receives an impression from without, it's blank, and you write on it and fill it with all sort of data. But what is the typewriter paper? It's the passive recipient of the data or the impressions that are stamped upon it from the outside. But a word processor screen shows you what has been already organized and processed by a word processing program that takes data, organizes it, and makes it intelligible and presents it to you. Previous philosophers, from Descartes to Hume, assumed that the mind must conform to objects. There was a strong realism in them. But Kant said this: if you follow that approach, what do you get with Hume? You get a dead end of skepticism. You don't know if the mind is actually accessing an objective reality. You can't rationally verify induction. You can't rationally verify substance. You can't rationally verify personal identity, because all you have are a disjointed bundle of perceptions. And if you ask the question of where the rationalist, continental rationalist tradition goes, what happens? Descartes becomes a dualist, Leibniz becomes a monist, an atomist, and Spinoza becomes a monist. They're arbitrary. So Kant asks this question: whether we might not have more success in the task of metaphysics if we suppose that objects must conform to knowledge. Or to put it differently, Kant proposed that the objects of our understanding must conform to the mind's constructive activity. The mind is constructively active, in making sense data intelligible. Another illustration that I got from Dr. Bahnsen back in the 90s when I studied with him: what happens if you try to transport water and you put it in your hands? What does it do? It's fluid and it leaks right through your fingers, and pretty soon what you had in your hand has dissipated, has dissolved, has evaporated, and it's gone. But what happens if you take that same water, put it in an ice cube tray, and freeze it? Well, the water conforms to those categories that are in that ice tray, and that ice tray brings a unity and an organization to that water that is not possible apart from the organizing activity of that ice tray. Well, however you want to think of it, Kant argued that the mind takes chaotic and loose sense impressions and forms them and makes them intelligible. The mind makes experience intelligible so that whatever objects there are outside the mind must conform to the categories of the mind. So Kant agreed with Locke and Hume and says nothing can be known apart from sense experience. But he disagrees with Locke and Hume and says that whatever we know is produced by the constructive organizing activity of the mind. He says the understanding is itself the lawgiver of nature. Now, in terms of being a bit more precise, Kant said not only is the mind actively constructive, it's an active thing, but he said that the mind imposes at least two kinds of intelligibility on experience. And in terms of his philosophy, he talked of the transcendental aesthetic and the transcendental analytic. The transcendental aesthetic and the transcendental analytic. And I want to explain those briefly to you. According to Kant, when we have any experience whatsoever, the mind takes the categories of experience and in the transcendental analytic aesthetic organizes or imposes a spatial and temporal pattern upon all things that we experience. The world in itself is chaotic and unknowable, but the mind, the knowing mind, has a priori categories that constructively form the world into categories of space, objects that can move, and objects in time, objects that endure through different times. Space and time are categories that are imposed actively by the knowing mind, so that when you know the space-time world, what you are knowing are the structures in the mind that are imposed upon the world so that objects appear intelligible due to what? Due to the constructive categories of the knowing mind. Kant called this a transcendental deduction. You cannot have intelligible experience of objects apart from the categories of space and time. And rather than space and time being things that are given to the mind, they are rather things the mind imposes on experience. Now, the transcendental analytic goes on to impose additional categories of quantity, quality, relation, modality, etc. The mind is what imposes on the nature of space-time objects those additional features of quantity, quality, relation, and causation. Now, the point, the reason why Kant, by almost all philosophers, is referred to as an idealist is because Kant enshrined more than any philosopher prior to his time the idea that to the extent that we know objects or perceptions of things, they conform to the constructive activity of the mind, which in the transcendental aesthetic organizes knowledge in terms of space and time, and the transcendental analytic that gives a logical, quantitative, qualitative assessment to those things, modality, necessity, etc. So that the genius of Kant's philosophy is that the precondition that makes experience intelligible is the constructive activity of the individual ego. Now, he also said conveniently that everyone has exactly the same categories, but his point is that the intelligibility of experience is a function of the knowing mind. Objects appear intelligible because of the constructive, legislative function of the ego, and he calls this a transcendental approach. Now, that is a very brief overview of Kant. And there's more to say in terms of detail. We could talk not only about theoretical reason, which is what this is, but practical reason, which is how you try to access God. But that's for a later point in a more advanced course. But here's what I want you to appreciate. Van Til himself used the language of a transcendental approach to apologetics. Kant termed this approach a transcendental deduction of the categories that make experience intelligible. It's a, if you put it most broadly, Kant's idealism is a transcendental idealism. The conditions for the possibility of intelligible experience are supplied by the knowing mind, which actively brings unity and coherence and intelligibility to chaotic bundles of perceptions. And Van Til, in the Survey of Christian Epistemology, says that a truly transcendental method takes any fact which it wishes to investigate and tries to determine what the presuppositions of such a fact must be in order to make it what it is. In other words, Van Til's saying that just as Kant asks the question, what is it that makes the facts and laws intelligible? What is it that brings facts and laws together in a meaningful relationship of space and time and quantity and quality and modality and possibility and necessity and contingency? Kant said, it's the knowing constructive ego. And when Van Til talks about a transcendental method, it's very easy to say, well, if Kant was using a transcendental method, and Van Til says he's using a transcendental method, then it must be the case that Van Til is a Kantian or he's conceded to Kant. But listen to what he says that places him on such a collision course with Kant only one page later on page 11 in the Survey of Christian Epistemology. Any method, he says, as was pointed out above, that does not maintain that not a single fact has meaning unless it be God that gives that fact meaning is an anti-Christian method. He goes on to say, now the only argument for an absolute God that holds water is a transcendental argument. The transcendental argument seeks to discover what sort of foundations the house of human knowledge must have in order to be what it is. A truly transcendent God and a transcendental method go hand in hand. And then he says on page 201 this. It's not as though we already know some facts and laws to begin with, irrespective of the existence of God, in order then to reason from such beginning to further conclusions. It is certainly true that if God has any significance for any object of knowledge at all, the relation of God to that object of knowledge must be taken into consideration from the outset. It is this fact that the transcendental method seeks to recognize. Now, let me try to put it as pointedly as I know how to put it. Van Til and Kant are in an absolutely antithetical an antagonistic relationship on the intelligibility of the objects of experience. Kant is saying that God cannot be invoked by virtue of theoretical reason. He posited an entirely different form of reason to even speak of God, and argues that it is the knowing mind that renders objects intelligible transcendentally. The human mind is the precondition for the intelligibility of the appearance of objects. And Van Til is saying at least this, not a single fact can be known unless God, in his decree, in his creation, in his condescension, in his providence, makes that fact known. And secondly, that the relation of God to the object of knowledge must be taken into consideration from the outset. For Kant, knowledge of God cannot be taken into account from the outset because theoretical reason cannot reach God and does not deal with God. So we need to remember that according to Van Til, the Christian apologist has to take seriously from the outset the absolute character of God's being when formulating an argument for Christian theism. And that means that we don't begin with either deductive or inductive methods of argument per se, nor do we begin with the actively constructive character of the mind that conforms objects to it, because from the outset, it is God himself who renders objects intelligible to all knowing minds. And so the very thing that Kantian idealism enshrines is what Van Til says a truly reformed transcendental approach must reject in principle. By way of contrast between the two, there is no peaceful coexistence between the transcendental idealism of Kant and Van Til's transcendental approach that is arguing for the impossibility of the contrary and affirms that objects are intelligible only given the being, existence, and revelation of the triune God. It's for those who know both philosophy and theology as antithetical a relation as is conceivable. So if we were to try to say then that Van Til was in some way concessive to transcendental idealism of a Kantian variety, the response to that is his critique is the most antithetical critique of transcendental idealism conceivable, because it's not the mind of man, but it's God himself who renders predication possible. And that must be taken into account from the outset of reasoning. Kant cannot affirm that at any point. Now that is transcendental idealism. Let me do this now. Let me talk to you. And this one is more difficult to get across in a short time, but let me talk to you about Hegel and absolute idealism, particularly the Hegelian iteration of absolute idealism, and help you understand, and I don't think it will take too long, help you understand how Van Til is as antithetically opposed to Hegel as he is to Kant on this. So, Hegelian absolute idealism. And if I gave you extensive quotations from Hegel, it would take a lot longer to work through them. If you're aware of Hegel's philosophy, he is the king of abstraction. He's actually fascinating to read. And for you students of Van Til, we will be reading some Hegel when we deal with idealism. We'll also be reading some Royce, some Boesinkat, in order to understand the various permutations of absolute idealism. But Hegel is the father of absolute idealism. But Hegel believed, with Kant, that mind is constructive of what is not only intelligible, but mind is constructive of what is real. And Hegel argued that mind can know ultimate reality, and he sought to reconfigure reason in a way that transcended Kant's formulation. Now, Hegel was a difficult philosopher to understand, but for our purposes, we need three guiding principles to understand Hegel's philosophy, just the general orientation. First, he believed that ultimate reality is one developmental rational unity. One developmental rational unity, and it was Geist or spirit. Secondly, that ultimate reality is the developmental outworking of not only reason, but what Hegel called mind. So there's one developmental rational unity. Secondly, that developmental rational unity is Geist or mind. And third, absolute mind comes to full self-conscious understanding of what is universally true and perfectly precise through an historical dialectical process of becoming. And at the end of that process is a concrete universal. Now, let me try to break this down and make it as clear as possible. And I'm thankful this is recorded and you can listen to it over and over again. But Hegel believed absolute mind, the absolute mind, is submerged in a process of change in history so that it comes to be absolute through a process of intellectual growth that incorporates more and more universal concepts with more and more factual data in an evolution toward knowledge of the absolute truth. Reality for Hegel is absolute mind, and he drew a fundamental distinction between mind and nature. Mind and nature. Mind is a principle of timeless unity. Nature is the principle of historical particularity. And mind and nature are reciprocally related in a developmental and historical process. Hegel posited there is an absolute spirit, a principle of unity and rationality. An absolute spirit is what reconciles mind and nature in an historical process. Reason, then, as it unfolds in history, unfolds according to a dialectical movement. And the dialectical movement of mind and nature is in a triadic movement that we're going to call a thesis, an antithesis, and a synthesis, by which the absolute comes progressively to full self-consciousness. Reality is absolute mind. An absolute mind is coming to self-consciousness progressively through the details and particulars of nature, integrating them into its becoming as an absolute subject. So the absolute mind is in back of all particular subjective minds. This is where Hegel outstrips Kant. For every individual mind that knows, that mind participates in and is an example of the absolute mind that is coming to full self-consciousness through the world of nature. But the point for Hegel is that the absolute mind, the initial timeless unity of that absolute mind, needs the detailed historical particularity of nature in order to come to full self-consciousness. So to understand the nature of thought, the nature of reason, the nature of mind in relation to nature, is to understand the movement of absolute mind through the process of history, incorporating all of its particulars into its own understanding. Now, the process then is that mind, which is initially separate from nature, incorporates nature into itself through a dialectical process. Partial truth exists at every point throughout the stage of mind knowing nature, of mind reciprocally relating to nature and incorporating its details into its unity. And people are expressing, individuals are expressing partial truths in everything they say, and all partial truth is an instance of the absolute mind coming to full self-consciousness through nature. And so all of reality, to use an illustration, is likened to an individual person coming to understand in more detail the color of a wall. For instance, a naive person would look at a wall and say, "This wall, which is over to my left, is a white wall." Another person would come along and say, "That wall does not look white to me. It looks yellow. So person one would have a thesis, the wall is white. Person two would have an antithesis, no, the wall isn't white, the wall is yellow. But the person who's more sophisticated and in whose individual mind, the absolute mind, is coming to self-consciousness would say, no, the wall is neither purely white nor purely yellow. It is Winburn white, which is a white-based paint with yellow tones, a yellow hue. So it's neither white nor yellow. It's neither the thesis nor the antithesis. It's the synthesis. All knowledge of finite minds is like that, and all finite minds are coming to self-consciousness through a process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And in back of every individual finite mind coming to self-consciousness in that triadic process is the absolute mind coming to incorporate all of the universals and particulars in nature into a comprehensive monism of absolute spirit. This means something basic. The absolute for Hegel is in an incremental process through thesis, antithesis, and synthesis of arriving at comprehensive knowledge, knowledge that is both universal and detailed and factually precise. And that knowledge is the movement toward concrete universal knowledge, knowledge that is absolutely inclusive of the sum total of reality, but knowledge that is adequate to all of the factual details. So it's not knowledge that a wall is white or yellow, but it's a knowledge that it's Winburn white. And then it's not only knowledge of the color of the wall, it's the knowledge of the composition of the wall and the function of the wall and the telos of the wall and the relation of the wall to the rest of the building and the building to the rest of reality. All history is a process of the outworking of absolute spirit, so that the predicates that we apply to history, Hegel says, actually apply to the absolute itself. And that sets Hegelian idealism on an absolute collision course with Van Til's conception of God as absolute. Where does the difference lie? Here it is. The God of Christian theism is a God whose knowledge determines all unity and diversity in history and does not depend on history for his completeness. But for Hegel, the absolute himself is constituted by a reciprocal relation to the changing world of particulars in nature and needs those particulars in order to be self-complete. In other words, for Hegel, the absolute is in a reciprocal and interdependent relation with the world of nature and cannot be complete without it. But for Van Til, God is self-complete. For the Reformed tradition, God is self-contained prior to and apart from any relation to particulars, and the moment of history in any particular instance and the sum total of the space-time world depends on him for its intelligibility of meaning, and he does not depend on it at all or at any point. Now, what that helps you see is that when Van Til chooses to use the language of concrete universal, which he uses in Defense of the Faith, he's using it in a manner similar to the way John uses logos in John 1. John took a term from Stoic philosophy, an impersonal principle of rationality, and he filled it with the content of the pre-existent Son of God, who has come into the world in assumed flesh, antithetically related to the Logos in Stoic philosophy. Van Til is doing something functionally identical with the language of concrete universal. When he says God is a concrete universal, he doesn't mean that God needs the world of space and time to become a concrete universal at the end of an historical process on which he is dependent. He rather means that God is self-complete and the condition for the possibility of all unity and diversity in the space-time world. So just as there was an absolute an antithetical contrast between transcendental idealism, Kant and Van Til, so likewise there is an absolute contrast between absolute idealism, Hegel, and Van Til. Van Til is neither a subjective idealist, nor a transcendental idealist, nor an absolute idealist of a German, American, or British iteration. And so what we have to appreciate about Van Til is that when he says that God is a concrete universal, what is the purpose for that? It is in order to make the antithesis between the God of Christian theism absolute in relation to the mutable, changing, developmental mind or spirit that is coming to self-consciousness through nature, which he needs in order to arrive at self-consciousness. And so when we think about the De Boers or van der Stelts or any others in the 20th, 21st century who have said that Van Til is guilty of idealism, there's a fundamental and baseline lack of appreciation for the nature of the various forms of idealism that Van Til opposed. Over against Kant, it is the divine that makes objects of perception intelligible. It is his existence in revelation that must be taken into account from the outset. And therefore, transcendental is being used in a fundamentally antithetical way to Kant for an apologetical purpose. And likewise with concrete universal. Van Til is not conceding an inch to the absolute idealist when he identifies the self-contained God as a concrete universal. Now, once we understand that, we have a template in place to see that Van Til's doctoral dissertation, God in the Absolute, 1927, remained a consistent argument throughout his entire career. And what was that argument? I'll just make it basic. That argument was that absolute idealism, whether it's German, British, French, or American, reduces to pragmatism. Why? Because for pragmatism, what is ultimate? Time, change, and chance in history. For the idealist, the absolute idealist, what does the absolute need in order to become fully self-conscious and diverse? He needs the natural order of historical particularity to be incorporated into his evolving as the absolute. And at the end of the day, an evolving, historically conditioned absolute is no absolute. It's functionally identical to pragmatism. And so when we understand this, we can understand that Van Til is, in my estimate, the most penetrating and trenchant critic of idealism in the history of Reformed theology. Far from being one who concedes to it, he drew in a heroic and admirable way a line of demarcation in the sand that sets the self-contained ontological trinity over against Kant's constructive ego, over against Hegel's mutable absolute who needs the world in order to become self-conscious and fully actualized. Van Til said over against both is the fully actualized, self-complete, self-contained ontological trinity. It is this God that we worship, and he cannot be reduced to any construction of the idealist tradition. Now, when we study idealism in more detail later in the course, when we get to that module, we'll be able to appreciate more of this from Van Til, but it must be said at the outset that his work stands as perhaps the most trenchant criticism of idealism recorded by any theologian of the Reformed tradition in the 20th century.
Thank you for listening to the Reformed Academy podcast. We hope you enjoyed this lecture. We want to remind you that all of our courses are available online entirely for free at reformedforum.org, and they also include Spanish and Chinese subtitles. But we also want to remind you that we are only able to do this with your support. So if you are excited about this theology and want to enable people around the world to watch and listen to these free resources, and for us to produce many more courses, then please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to provide your support. Thank you so much, and we hope you join us again next week on the Reformed Academy podcast.